the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
And my company... We're on the extreme right flank of the landing area of Omaha. At Point de Hoc, which we had to capture, we hit the beach. I was the first one wounded, machine gun through the right side. We still had to get up the cliffs, and we'd send up six grapnel hooks over the cliff to 100 to 150 feet, which the men were going to climb up this rope, and we did. So part of the Germans' attack upon us was to cut those ropes, and they're trying to drive us back into the sea or kill us as we're trying. We can't fight back when we're climbing the ropes.
Hello, I'm Gene Pell. Sergeant Leonard Lommel was in the vanguard of the Allied landing on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, June 6, 1944. One of 200 elite Army Rangers, his assignment was to carry out a seemingly impossible mission. His objective was Point du Hoc, a sheer rock cliff that protruded into the English Channel. Point du Hoc was heavily fortified and manned by battle-hardened German troops. Aerial reconnaissance had revealed an emplacement of six 155-millimeter cannons atop the cliff. Each was capable of pouring deadly shells on the main invasion forces assaulting Omaha and Utah beaches. They could also reach ships and landing craft headed for the shore. They had to be silenced. Sergeant Lommel's mission was critical. Only a few years earlier, Leonard Lommel's experience of the ocean was entirely different from the stinging cold spray now assaulting his landing craft. The Atlantic had once provided steady work and many hours of fun and recreation.
Well, I'm from the Jersey Shore. I presently live in Toms River, New Jersey, where my wife grew up. I married her and moved there. Because it's the county seat, but I grew up 15 miles north of there in Point Pleasant Beach on the ocean near an inlet where the major industry was fishing, and the population was mostly Scandinavian, of course, and my folks were Scandinavian folks. My mother was from Norway, my father was from Sweden. And living on the Jersey coast, I enjoyed all the privileges of sailing, boating, fishing, commercially that is, and it carried us through the Depression, and that's what was important when I was young. And we had many jobs, we young fellas, and we're still friends to this day that worked those jobs. We'd caddy all day and work the boardwalk all night, and then head for a special place that we could just strip off and go swimming in the nice salt water of the Atlantic around midnight, 1 o'clock, home for sleep, and then start all over the next day. This was the Depression, of course.
As the United States struggled to emerge from the Great Depression, Hitler's Third Reich was on the march in Europe. The Rhineland had been reoccupied. Plans were in place for the annexation of Austria and the Sudetenland, and an alliance had been struck with the Italian dictator and founder of fascism, Benito Mussolini, the conqueror of Ethiopia. The democracies of the world, unprepared to risk war, followed a policy of appeasement as a third totalitarian nation, Japan, savagely invaded China in 1937.
I graduated from high school in 37, graduated from college in 41, and then December of that year was Pearl Harbor. Well, it didn't take a rocket specialist to figure out that all us young guys were going to be in a certain place at a certain time, and I was among them, and we went into the Army. Where they took us was by the busloads from the town of Point Pleasant to Fort Dix, which is 35 miles away, where we all stood in the field, 10,000 of us, speculating on what the Army was going to do with us, our specialties, what we had to offer, and to make a long story short, there was some interesting discussions and declarations that didn't amount to a row of beans, because out came the sergeant and said, "You're all in the infantry. You have a choice at all." So we start out in the infantry, and the regular infantry wasn't enough for me, and I heard about the Rangers. I went to a Ranger school, the first Ranger school that trained Rangers. That was Fort Meade, Maryland, and a division was the 76th Division, the Liberty Bell Division. At that point in time, I'd worked my way up from private to about to be appointed a first sergeant of a regimental company, headquarters company, the 417th Regiment of the 76th Division. I had been chosen. There was a middleweight, professional middleweight boxer, George Bader, B-A-D-E-R was his name, and myself were appointed by our company commander, Captain Nelson, to go to this school. And there was a couple hundred of us in that school wearing coveralls. You weren't allowed to tell your name to anybody. You weren't allowed to tell your rank. You were a nobody in there because we had lots of things to learn, and among them was hand-to-hand combat. And I guess they didn't want us to be able to trace each other for a beating you might take in one of those episodes. But anyway, to make a long story short, of the 200, it was only about half of them graduated, and I was one of the lucky ones that graduated. George did, too. The idea at that point in time was for us, a couple hundred guys that were chosen for that, was to come back into the division and teach the regular companies, be instructors down through the ranks, teaching them on Ranger tactics and everything. So one day I got a call from the executive officer of the 76th Division, and he said, "Lomel, how would you like to be a Ranger? We have been discussing this, and we'd like to offer you the first sergeancy of a Ranger company to be organized, a real Ranger company." So I did, and I took about 65, 70 men, volunteers, to be regular Rangers, to go to Camp Forest, Tennessee, Tullahoma, Tennessee, where we organized. See, the same thing was being done all over the country. And we finally had a battalion of 500 men. And what we did was go through 2,000 volunteers to get 500 men that would pass all the tests and become the 2nd Ranger Battalion of World War II. We had these 6 battalions, you know, 3,000 Rangers all told in World War II. 1 battalion in the 6th Battalion in the Pacific, the 5 battalions in the European Theater of Operation. I was 2nd, but Company D, 2nd Ranger Battalion, World War II.
15 months after Pearl Harbor, Len Lomel and his fellow Army Rangers were on their way to the war in Europe. 15,000 soldiers packed onto the Queen Elizabeth. They had no idea where or when they would first experience combat, only the certainty that they would. In the meantime, there would be day after day and night after night of training, training, and more training.
Having started off on April the 1st, 1943, we were on a troop ship in November of 1943 going to Scotland, meeting our commando friends for the first time, and with them helping with the training and other special trainings. We did not realize it, but we were being trained especially for the D-Day operation we all know was inevitable, that there was going to be an invasion of the continent, but we knew nothing about anything, and we only did what we were told and so forth. I'm not trying to be humorous when I say this, but we climbed so many cliffs in that year of preparation that we thought there's got to be a cliff in our future somewhere. What are we doing this every day almost for? And those cliffs were 300 or 400 feet high without safety ropes, and we only kept the best and the fastest on the ropes, free climbing, which was exciting, and there was all sorts of punishments and things if you didn't do what you were told in that regard, and such as if you didn't do it or refuse or even hesitated, you were out. They would dismiss you from the Rangers if you had to do it. However, there were some good climbers that had ideas. Today is not going to be a good day. I don't feel right. I might slip and fall. And, well, we would be understanding of him, but he would have to work. He would have to walk maybe 6 paces behind his platoon, showing whoever was understood our methods that he was in doubt if he was going to be accepted or not. And I can remember some great guys who had to do that, but they got back on the ball and went all the way with us. We were told in April of 1944 that our mission was going to be Point du Hoc. Well, they didn't say Point du Hoc. They said, your mission is going to be to climb a cliff, as if we didn't know after all the cliffs we had climbed. But they didn't tell us where. And they told us it would be in about a month, I think, of June. And we were, at that point in time, we were in a marshalling area. We were not allowed to talk to anybody about this invasion coming up. Only our own squad or our own platoon in the area. We were confined and locked in, and no word was to get out. And, of course, we didn't know. The only thing we had to study to prepare ourselves were aerial photographs. And we studied them and prepared ourselves for what we were to do, which was the mission was a three-part mission. Climb the cliffs of Point du Hoc, capture the point, which became a third beachhead of D-Day, and we had to get the six guns, these tremendous 155-millimeter coastal guns that could fire 10, 12 miles to sea and could fire on all of our invasion fleet laying out there, thousands of ships, and could fire on Utah Beach and Omaha Beach and kill thousands of soldiers and sailors. And our mission was to climb those cliffs, find those guns as quickly as possible. They were supposed to be where they said they were with these photographs, and get them out of action, get to the coast road, which is a mile inland, throw up a roadblock there, keep the Germans from coming from Utah Beach on the west to the men, the Germans, on Omaha Beach to help them. We were to cut them off so they couldn't help the Germans' division that was on that beach there. And the third part was to destroy all the communications so the Germans couldn't be in touch with each other. And D Company men did it all.
We'll return with more of the story of Point du Hoc after this short break.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
After 2 years of invasion planning, after giant rehearsal maneuvers in England and false wet runs in the Channel, D-Day, June 6, 1944, still was a tactical surprise. The German High Command expected the attack to come at the Pas-de-Calais, north of the River Seine, where the Channel is narrowest. It was there, along the coast, that Hitler put the bulk of his panzer divisions. If the Germans had known where and when the Allies were coming, they could have hurled them back into the sea with the 55 divisions they had in France. The Allies would have been on the offensive with a 10-to-1 man ratio against them. At 6:30 on the morning of June 6, Army Sergeant Leonard Lommel and his Rangers were to begin their capture of the big German guns atop the cliffs of Point du Hoc.
Now, we had to run the gauntlet 300 or 400 yards off that all those cliffs, with the Germans firing at us with rifles, machine guns, anti-aircraft guns, and mortars trying to blow us out of the water. Some guys got hit about 3 miles out running that gauntlet D-Day morning. That put us late about a half hour to land at Point de Hoc, which we had to capture.
The first company to go ashore lost 96% of its men without firing a shot. Nearly 800 of the 2,000 men in the 116th Regiment of the 29th Infantry Division were killed or wounded. There were 30 men in my landing craft, recalls Robert Sales, and I was the only one who lived long enough to get onto the beach. The small town of Bedford, Virginia, lost 19 men at Omaha Beach, all of them in the first 15 minutes. Amid withering fire, Army Rangers set about scaling the cliffs of Pointe du Hoc. The London Fire Department had provided them with four 75-foot extension ladders. A landing craft carrying one of them had been sunk by enemy fire. The slippery clay and rock at the base of the cliff ruled out use of the others. Only one was ever extended, and almost immediately it was brought back down. The only way to reach the top was by climbing ropes, but the ropes first had to get to the top and somehow be anchored. Sergeant Jack Kuhn was one of two Rangers who had been assigned to solve the problem during training.
It's easy to go up on a cliff and drop your ropes down the cliff. But how do you get ropes up the cliff if the enemy's up there waiting for you? Well, the British commandos saw that Captain Duke Slater, my company commander, and I had been assigned to find some way to get ropes up the cliff, and this was the answer. They were rockets. These rockets were capable of going in the air high enough to clear a 100-foot cliff and going inland far enough that when the grapnel hooks at the end of the rope landed, they could be sunk into the ground. We could then climb the ropes. Len Lamel and to my right would fire the three rockets on his side, and I would fire the three rockets on my side. Now, there was no way of aiming. There was no way of timing with machinery or anything. You had to do it by practice. And each boat that was in there, there was D, E, and F Company, and each boat that was there had the small boats with ropes. And we all started firing at about the same time. And we were very pleased to see the ropes clean the cliffs and were up there for us to climb. Now, when we moved in and the boats hit an area where we knew that we could jump out of the boats, we thought safely, we bailed out. We opened the doors on the front. They were very small craft, allowing three men together to go out at the same time. Now, the beach was very narrow, and we knew that shortly after landing, the beach would be underwater from the tide coming in, and if we didn't get up, we'd perish because our boats that brought us in had to back out and leave to protect them from being sunk.
We hit the beach. I was the first one wounded, machine gun through the right side. We still had to get up the cliffs. We went to our designated objective. My D Company had three gun positions, 4, 5, and 6, on the west side of the cliff where we were supposed to originally come up, but we couldn't take the time to get around the point to come up there. So we went in with the other guys. I'd lost my company commander and we lost two LCAs with very important personnel in it from my company. Headquarters knows that. And so we had to do it on our own. So I said, oh, we're not going to go around this and waste time going around this side. We'll lay in where everybody's right now, and we'll fight our way over to them, find the gun positions, and take it from there. So the Germans' attack upon us was to drive us back into the sea or kill us as we're trying. We can't fight back when we're climbing the ropes.
They couldn't look down to see you, but they could roll rocks, grenades, and anything get their hands on, which they didn't even cut some of the ropes.
So what we had were specialists, guys that were especially good at it. And they got up there with a BAR and brushed the Germans back to enable us to get over the top.
As we were doing this, the men were climbing the cliffs, and three fellows with me, that would be Koenig and Lamel and I, we got up the cliffs in good shape, and to our amazement found there were no guns there. Now, after all this planning and all this loss of manpower and equipment, we found out that their guns were gone.
There were no guns, as it was told to us there would be.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are
through your MP3 player.
Log on to www.radioamerica.org
and click on the podcasting icon.
Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.
You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes.
The Veterans Chronicles podcast,
now online
at radioamerica.org.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the Fuhrer's face.
Cheer for Harlem operate.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Crouching in a concrete bunker above Omaha Beach, peering through his binoculars, Major Werner Pluscott was one of the first Germans to see the D-Day invasion fleet appear on the horizon. It was dark and foggy, he remembers. Finally, the fog lifted, and I saw in front of me part of the Armada. It was gigantic. It was the sight of my life. There was an Armada of at least 10,000 warships moving without the slightest telltale sound or sight. We began searching for signal lights and listening for radio communication. Nothing. It was a model of discipline among the American and British military, rare among armies. I've never tired of praising the discipline of those troops. I called High Command West. They claimed the Allies didn't have such ships. They told me I was imagining things. Then I saw a purple flare shot about 300 meters into the air, and then a second arched into the morning sky. That was the signal for the entire Armada to maneuver around and face the coast. They slowly raised their cannons, and then it began. They unleashed an inferno that made hell seem like child's play. That firing began just after 5 a.m. The whole sky turned bright red as the warships laid down a gigantic sheet of flame almost 100 miles long. Surviving such an attack was possible only because the Germans had built massive fortifications of concrete and steel. The most dangerous was thought to be the huge 155-millimeter guns atop Pointe du Hoc. Sergeant Leonard Lommel was one of the first Army Rangers to scale the cliff.
And we got over to our gun position. It was empty. It had telephone poles sticking out. And from the air, it looked like gun barrels or tubes. In some case, it was anything sticking out of, that would resemble that from the air. But anyway, and we decided they'd never been there. And they hadn't been, it turned out later. So we said, we got to go find them. So and we're under a lot of fire. What was the worst of it all was I'd never seen a fire, an aircraft gun fired parallel to the top of land. I never saw that firing like a machine gun. So we were being shelled by 88s, crawling fire to our rear, just making us run forward. I kid about it that if they had not lifted that crawling fire, I'd have been to Berlin the first day. That's how frightened I was to be under crawling fire that was crawling up my back of my platoon. So we fortunately fought our way through fast to the coast road, where I told my section sergeants of the platoon of the guys I had. I started with 22 guys on the boat. By the time I got inland to the coast road, which is about a mile, I only had 22 left. I was the one boat that I know of that kept his men together. We moved as a unit. So my boat crew was one unit of my special rangers. So Sergeant Kuhn and I, he's alive, by the way, a retired chief of police out at Altoona, Pennsylvania. I said to the guys, listen, you guys set up the roadblock. Jack and I are going to go looking for those guns. We didn't know where to look. But we're not claiming any credit or glory for this, for the reason that the section sergeants, my staff sergeants, set up the roadblock properly, as I knew they would. Jack and I went down the one sunken road there was between these farms and pastures, not knowing where it led to. There was no place else to go. It didn't take a genius, but we saw marks on the road, which could have been a farm wagon, but we didn't know. You never, if you don't know, you don't go forward to find out, you're never going to find out. So we did, and we leapfrogged down that road, protecting each other. It came my turn to look over the hedgerow, and I looked over into this swale, this depression in an apple orchard, and there were the five guns, all camouflaged by leaf camouflage. And I told Jack to cover me, and I went in and destroyed them all.
Lomel and his men had been issued a new weapon, thermite grenades. Thermite is a mixture of aluminum powder and a metal oxide that, when ignited, generates a great deal of heat. It is used in welding and incendiary bombs.
We never had them before this mission, and they gave us each one to carry with our other load for climbing. So I only had his and mine. That was two, and I got five guns. So I destroyed two of them with the incendiary grenades, laying it in the traversing mechanism. And anywhere there was a gear, elevation or traversing, or the hinges of the breech blocks, because when we popped them, it's like a beer can. And the chemical compound in there seeps into the crevices around it, and the air hits that, and it firms up. It's just like you're soldering every hinge or every gear. We had two, and I'm in there by myself because there's 75 guys from the gun crew. They're over there about 100 yards away being talked to by their leader. It's 8 o'clock, 8:15 in the morning. And so I don't know if there's some guard in there sound asleep, but I go in to find him. I luck out. As a matter of fact, as I've pointed out zillions of times, as far as Jack and I were concerned, we were just doing our job as a couple of good non-coms on patrol, looking for some guns, and we found them. Lucked out. We were at the right place at the right time. We were trained to do what we had to do. We did what we had to do and prevailed. But anyway, I got two of the guns out with a thermite grenade. I took my submachine gun, took my field jacket off, wrapped it around the butt, and smashed the sights of the rest of the guns. So I did as much damage as I could do at that point. And I ran back to Jack, who was up high, you see, keeping an eye on the Germans. I told him when I got in there, pinwheel the first one that even looks this way, because I can't see them. I'm down in the depression. And I went back to him. I said, Jack, we got to go back to the guys on the road a couple hundred yards away and get their hand grenades and get back here. He said, okay, let's go. So it's a sunken road, see. You can't see over those roads. And they got hedgerows 9 feet tall, and they got 60-foot trees above that. So the hedgerow that I speak of is a real wall that you could put a column of tanks in this sunken road and never seen it by from the coast road along that coast. That's the kind of roads they have in those farms. Came back and put out the rest of the guns, never saw us. And not only were they there within 100 yards of us, 200 we had seen before we even left coming at us from the east, coming west toward us. They passed within 20 feet of us, and we stopped breathing so they wouldn't hear us breathe. We were hidden in a ditch, you know, and we pulled stuff over us, and we could hear them going by. They never dreamed that early in the morning there were a couple rangers a mile inland behind the second line of defense, having come through two lines of defense and weathered their crawling fire and everything else. We did not waste time. If we had to kill a guy, we killed him. The idea was find the guns as quick as you can, destroy them, destroy the communications, and set up the roadblock and keep the Germans up in the eastern part, Utah Beach area, from getting down to Omaha Beach to protect. So thousands of soldiers and sailors' lives were depending upon us. As commanding officer Omar Bradley said as he gave that mission to Colonel Rutter. It was the most dangerous mission of D-Day and one of the most important ones. And it was the first one completed, the first mission completed on D-Day.
The next task facing Lommel was to get word to command that the mission had been accomplished.
How do we get the message back? Well, as soon as we finished the gun assignment, put them out of action, Jack and I ran like a couple scared rabbits back to the roadblock because we figured our luck had held out long enough. Somebody's bound to sense it. But they didn't, and we ran like the dickens, got back to our guys, and two of my sergeants, Harry Fate, he's still alive, and Sergeant Lunning, he's dead, they volunteered to take the message back to Colonel Rutter, mission accomplished, but they would go back by different routes. I will tell you something I've never said publicly before, but they took a couple prisoners with them, and I said, what are you doing that for? I said, well, we don't want them around here. We can't take care of them. So what they used those prisoners for was to go through the gates and crossroads and intersections they had to go to that were covered by German guns to test the intersection or the gateway that they would have to go through on their way back. See, we're over a mile inland out to the point to report to Colonel Rutter, whose CP was out there, mission accomplished, because if they hadn't done it that way, they would have been the guinea pigs that got shot in those intersections. Sergeant Fate would have one. He'd say, all right, he'd made that guy go through that intersection to the other side, and he kept him covered. If he lived, that was great. It was safe for Harry to come through. I was not in favor of that in the beginning, but I thought I'd mind my own business at that point. They were volunteering, and they were going to do it their way, and they were successful, and I don't argue with success, particularly when they're right to make you look good.
The late historian Stephen Ambrose has written that Pointe du Hoc remains to this day an overwhelming sight. It is hardly possible to say which is more impressive, writes Ambrose, the amount of reinforced concrete the Germans poured to build their casemates or the damage done to them by the bombs and shells of the Allies. Huge chunks of concrete, as big as houses, are scattered over the kilometer-square area as if the gods were playing dice. Surprisingly, the massive concrete observation post at the edge of the cliff remains intact. It was the key to the whole battery. From it, one has a perfect view of both Omaha and Utah beaches. German artillery observers in the post had radio and telephone communication with the batteries.
There were nobody manning a gun. Certainly they weren't manning a gun. They weren't getting any fire orders back from the point where their lookout was because E Company had them buttoned up, killing all their observers and officers in the observation point out on Pointe du Hoc. So there were no fire orders coming back. There was no point in the Germans sitting in their position and about to attract some fire from the Texas, a battleship Texas, for the reason that their 88s, German 88s, gave us a hard time in crawling fire, and that information was going out to the Texas to come in to fire on wherever they could figure out where those 88s might be, and they just might have figured that that was the 88s that were firing, and it wasn't. So the smart Germans, they're good soldiers, you know. They knew that was not the big place to sit around and relax at that point in time. So what they were being was critiqued by their officer, bringing them up to date on the progress of the invasion up to that moment. They did not know that Sergeant Kuhn and I were in their midst, and we were very grateful for that. But that's why they weren't firing. They didn't have firing orders because of the E Company out there. But as far as we're concerned, we did what we had to do, what we were faced with. We destroyed them and got back and set up our defenses for that night. And now as far as the Germans, when they found out their guns had been destroyed, they gave us a good pounding for the rest of the day and that night and attacked us in horrendous counterattacks.
War correspondent Ernie Pyle observed the resulting devastation. The wreckage was vast and startling, he recalled. Scores of tanks, trucks, jeeps, and barges were submerged in the water for more than a mile into the sea. The shoreline was a museum of carnage. On the beach lay expended, sufficient men and mechanism for a small war. They were gone forever now. Of the 200 Rangers who began the battle for Pointe du Hoc, only 50 were still capable of fighting at the end.
When we were relieved, I was sent back because my wounds were infected with gangrene. And I walked down the road, and there were all the dead guys from my company laying out along both sides of the road waiting for Graves registration. That was a shocker. I have never, ever gotten out of my mind seeing them. And there was blood and dust in their beards and on their faces. And, you know, it had only been a day or two before. I'd been with those before they died. They died, I didn't even know they were dead.
The strength of bonds forged in combat are such that they can never be broken. So it was and is with the men of Company D, 2nd Ranger Battalion. In 1989, Leonard Lomel joined his surviving comrades-in-arms on a return visit to Normandy to look once again at the cliffs of Pointe du Hoc.
In 1989, I took a group of my survivors back to Normandy, and we ran into some German soldiers that were officer candidates at 1989 with their textbooks, and their version of what happened there or anywhere, it was always that they, the Germans, claimed to be outmanned 10-1. And I felt that that was ridiculous. The reverse of that was true. We were in their backyard. We are brothers, as it all started in World War II, and it's gotten stronger. My own children were teenagers before they realized that Uncle Joe and Uncle Dominic and Uncle Reginus were not their true blood uncles. But that's all they ever knew, and that's the way it was with all of us. It's that way today. 58 years later, we're close as blood brothers, and we're just as argumentative as ever.
We're family. We're like brothers. Ranger friendships are forever is the password. We love each other in a spiritual way. It's we lived and died with them, and we lived with them for 2.5 to 3 years, and the ranks are thinning. They're passing away quite rapidly now, but they're deep within our thoughts. There isn't a day goes by you don't think about your buddies. Not a day.
When we return, our weekly salute to an American military hero.
Veterans Chronicles is now podcasting at radioamerica.org. Log on to our website, click on the podcasting icon, and look for Veterans Chronicles. Once there, follow the instructions on your computer to subscribe to our podcast. You'll always find our most recent program on the Veterans Chronicles podcast, in addition to past programs from our archives. The Veterans Chronicles podcast, free and online at radioamerica.org. Also available on Apple iTunes.
And now our weekly World War II Chronicles and our salute to an American military hero.
The Battle of Midway in early June convinced the U.S. Navy that it had gained the initiative in the Pacific. To exploit this advantage, Allied strategists developed a plan for moving on the air base at Rabaul on the island of New Britain. The first objective in the plan was an assault on the Solomon Islands just to the southwest. On the morning of August 7, 1942, U.S. Marines hit the beaches of Guadalcanal, Florida, and Tulagi Islands.
This afternoon, Admiral Ernest J. King, Commander-in-Chief of the United States Fleet, announced that American forces have now landed on the Solomon Islands, where heavy fighting is still raging. Admiral King emphasized that this action in the Solomon Islands is our first real offensive that we have launched, the first one at all in this war, and that considerable losses must therefore be expected.
This is the first time we've taken any territory away from the Japanese, and the Admiral confirms the impression of observers here that the fact that we have now moved to the offensive is of tremendous significance.
The landings were a complete surprise to the Japanese. In 24 hours, almost 18,000 American troops had landed.
Coming ashore in waves, they swarm across the beaches and immediately begin to dig in.
There seems no doubt that our Marines have effected several landings in the Solomons, that at least one Japanese land aerodrome is in our possession and in use, and that the initial landing parties of Marines have been strongly reinforced.
The aerodrome, renamed Henderson Field, would give the Americans control of the air over Guadalcanal, But the battle for Guadalcanal was just beginning.
Columns of Marines move into the interior to begin the long campaign to drive the Japanese from the remainder of the island.
I'm Ed Hurley. Join me next time for World War II Chronicles.
Welcome to Heroes of the Air, true stories of those who flew for America and earned the nation's supreme military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Heroes of the Air is brought to you by the Air Force Association, an independent nonprofit aerospace organization which promotes public understanding of the role aerospace power plays in our national defense. Your host for Heroes of the Air is Gene Pell.
The mission was daring and complicated. The flights of B-24s would take off from airfields in Libya, fly more than 1,200 miles, and approach their target area at treetop levels. The mission was also considered vital to the Allied war effort. Its purpose? Destroy German oil refineries that were the lifeblood of the Nazi war machine. 5 U.S. airmen would receive the nation's highest award for valor when it was over. Ploiești, Romania, August 1st, 1943. One of those 5 was Colonel John R. Kane of the Army Air Corps, who led the 3rd element of heavy bombers in the mass low-level attack. En route to the target, Colonel Kane's element became separated from the leading portion of the formation while avoiding dense and dangerous cumulus cloud conditions over mountainous terrain. But rather than turn back from such a vital mission, Colonel Kane elected to press on to the target. When he reached it, he discovered that another group had apparently missed its target and instead attacked and damaged the target assigned to his element. Despite the now thoroughly worn defensives, intensive anti-aircraft fire, enemy fighter planes, oil fires and explosions and dense smoke over the target, and the real danger of explosions from delayed action bombs previously dropped, Colonel Kane led his formation into the attack. By his brilliant courage, gallant leadership, and superior flying skill, he and the formation under his command successfully attacked the vast refinery that was so vital to the enemy war effort. Through his conspicuous gallantry in this most hazardous mission, and by his intrepidity at the risk of life above and beyond the call of duty, Colonel Kane made a vital personal contribution to the mission's success. Army Air Corps Colonel John S. Kane was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor in recognition of his gallantry, courage, and heroic acts.
The Air Force Association is proud to bring you Heroes of the Air, dedicated to those who earned the nation's highest military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Their service and sacrifice reflect an ideal that puts others and country above self. AFA salutes all men and women in the Air Force who so selflessly serve our country each day at home and around the globe. Heroes of the Air is produced by Pelcom Communications in association with Radio America.
That's it for this edition of Veterans Chronicles. Please come again next week. I'm Gene Pell, saying so long for now.
Veterans Chronicles, produced in Washington, D.C. by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. To learn more about this program or the American Veterans Center, log on to AmericanVeteransCenter.org.